Thank you very much, Michael. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me express my gratitude for the invitation. It's a pleasure to come. I tend to gauge institutions by their bookstores. This institution, I think, wins. It is the best new bookstore for my interests in this continent, and I have already shown my gratitude by considerable expenditure. Do you know that a book that I purchased yesterday, just to show how comprehensive their stock is, a book I purchased yesterday was actually published, it says this inside the volume, in 2015. Now that evinces a degree of comprehensiveness of stock I have never previously encountered. Now, the presentation I want to give this evening has been done with the assistance of my graduate helper at the university, at Baylor University in Texas, where I'm teaching this semester, and I wish to acknowledge her help at the start. She's Adina Johnson. In a couple of years, she'll need a job, so when she actually comes knocking on your door, please remember her name, Adina Johnson. My topic this evening is the legacy of George Whitefield. In 1865, a novel was published in London called The Diary of Mrs. Kitty Trevelyan. The writer was described as the author of the chronicles of the Schoenberg-Cotter family, and that is the story of Luther seen through the eyes of his printer's children, published 2 years before and a huge literary success. The author, preferring anonymity because she was a woman, was Elizabeth Charles, then in her late 30s, who was able to write extensively because of a childless marriage. Elizabeth had been swayed by the Oxford movement, attached to the Roman Catholic Church, rescued from the brink of actual conversion by a Swiss Protestant pastor, and had become a friend of the wife of Dean Stanley, the leading figure amongst broad churchmen in the Church of England. She therefore had very wide religious sympathies, and they were apparent in her historical fiction. The subtitle of The Diary of Mrs. Kitty Trevelyan was A Story of the Times of Whitefield and Wesley. The fictional author of the diary, Kitty, is invited with her aunt and cousin Evelyn to attend an evening meeting at the London residence of the Countess of Huntingdon, Whitefield's evangelical patroness. The lady who invites them had recently, she notes in her diary, become very religious. The inviter recommended the preacher as a wonderful orator, no commonplace fanatic. His discourses, the friend tells Kitty's aunt, are quite such as you would admire, quite suited to people of the highest intellectual powers. And so the aunt and the two girls attend, with cousin Evelyn professing conversion soon afterwards. What does Kitty remember of Whitefield? Just a man, she records, striving with his whole heart and soul to win lost souls out of a perishing, sorrowful world to Christ and holiness and joy. Just the conviction poured in on the heart by an overwhelming torrent of pleading, warning, tender, fervent eloquence that Christ Jesus the Lord cares more infinitely to win and save lost, wandering souls than man himself. Now, this impression of Whitefield is tinctured by the romantic sensibility of the age, rather like George Eliot's depiction of the Methodist preacher Dinah Morris in Adam Bede, published 6 years before. The representation of Whitefield and his message is more sentimental than accounts by the preacher's contemporaries. Yet it is highly revealing. Nearly a century after his death, Whitefield seemed worth celebrating in a popular novel. He'd become part of the folklore of England as a cultured man suited to the London salons and yet as a passionate evangelist and with superb rhetorical powers. Whitefield was a person who had entered the public memory. How was he remembered in the centuries after his death in 1770? We can distinguish seven different ways. Firstly, the man. Naturally, Whitefield's biographers normally represent the evangelist as a great man. First biographer, John Gillies, the Scottish Presbyterian minister, writing in 1772, was concerned to vindicate Whitfield's reputation. Exactly 200 years later, John Pollock, an evangelical Anglican clergyman, remained almost wholly uncritical. The biographers could point to contemporary estimates that applauded Whitfield's personal qualities. Thus, Joseph Belcher, a Baptist pastor who had emigrated from England to North America and wrote the standard biography of Whitfield in the mid-19th century, published by the American Tract Society in 1857, could quote the weighty opinion of Whitfield's American publisher, Benjamin Franklin, that the preacher was marked by integrity, disinterestedness, and indefatigable zeal in every good work. Belcher himself singled out as Whitfield's outstanding personal traits his indifference to his own honour and case, his being fond of labour, and his devotional spirit. And that was the normal image that was projected by biographers. Whitfield was unselfish, dizzyingly energetic, and profoundly devout. Even Wesleyan Methodist writers about Whitfield, who might have been expected to have a doctrinal axe to grind against the Calvinist opponent of the Arminian John Wesley, bore testimony to such qualities. Thus, Luke Tyerman, a Wesleyan minister writing a two-volume biography in 1876, while announcing that as an Arminian he differed from Whitfield, acknowledged the spiritual eminence of his subject. Whitfield's power, Tyerman claimed, was not in his talents, nor even in his oratory, but in his piety. Over a century later, Gordon Rupp, a leading Methodist historian, recognized in Whitfield a deep simplicity and an abiding generosity of spirit. So Whitfield was much celebrated for his personal qualities. Yet, the preacher's characteristics as a man were also subject to severe criticism. During Whitfield's lifetime, he was the object of scurrilous satire. In 1746, for example, he was represented as Dr. Preachfield, a hypocrite guilty of adultery, in a stage play by Charles Macklin, A Will or No Will. Samuel Foote, in the minor, labelled Whitfield's squintum, a name that stuck, because Whitfield's severe squint in his left eye marked him out, in order to suggest also moral delinquency through physiognomical defects. Whitfield's own circle included a few who acknowledged personal failings, thus Cornelius Winter, one of the ablest English preachers encouraged by Whitfield, admitted that he was impatient of contradiction. Subsequent writers sympathetic to Whitfield sometimes conceded his flaws. J.R. Andrews, an English barrister who celebrated Whitfield's glorious career in 1864, nevertheless felt bound to recognize that he was irritable at trifles and apt to form hasty judgments of people. Those with less regard for Whitfield could be far more censorious. Thus, Horton Davis, a historian of worship and theology in England, pointed to Whitfield's naivety, his deplorable lack of taste and insensitivity, and even an egotistical brashness. By the 20th century, writers sometimes felt compelled to look back with some condescension. Although Albert Belden was a devotee of Whitfield, who'd commenced the Congregational Mission Church in central London, of which Belden was superintendent. His 1930 biography dwelt on the psychology that he saw as a necessary tool of analysis in the modern world. Thus, Belden concluded that in Whitfield's career, the dominating unconscious motive was undoubtedly a strong reaction to an inferiority feeling. I like the word undoubtedly. The charge was also mounted in the 20th century that Whitfield was guilty of anti-intellectualism. Sidney Mead, amongst the most distinguished of American church historians, wrote in 1977 that Whitfield's revival style could hardly be dignified as an appeal to constructive reason. Whitfield was condemned as a representative of the whole revival tradition, and yet dismissive comment was also added of the man himself. He was culpably separating religion from intellect. Many criticisms are summarised in the current article in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography by Boyd Schlenker, a historian very familiar with the sources. Whitfield's treatment of his wife is a special cause of complaint there, but the preacher is also condemned for a variety of failings, including overconfidence and financial mismanagement. So, as Schlenker fairly concludes, there has been an enduring debate over the man, with some, including nearly all his biographers, almost entirely sympathetic and so verging on hagiography, and with others, on the other hand, strongly inclined to depict Whitfield in far less favourable terms. Whitfield was a man who in his day roused strong emotions for and against, and that division of opinion has remained ever since. Secondly, the preacher. The attention of posterity has rightly focused on Whitfield the preacher. Accounts of his brilliance as a public speaker abound in contemporary records, and therefore later judgments dwell also on his preaching legacy. J.P. Gledston, the Congregational Minister of Tottenham Court Road Chapel, once Whitfield's own congregation in central London, declared a century after the preacher's death that the influence of his popular oratory could still be traced in Gledston's own day. Often those who celebrated Whitfield's memory used the metaphor of fire. For John Glanville, Whitfield's successor in the mid-19th century at Bristol Tabernacle, the evangelist's preaching was all fire and flame, shooting out red-hot thunderbolts against the citadels of sin. Likewise, in the mid-20th century, Martin Lloyd-Jones, minister of Westminster Chapel, London, was an eminent pulpiteer of his day, well qualified to judge, spoke of Whitfield's sermons as not as polished essays, but as marked by the zeal, the fire, the passion, the flame of an ardent orator. Lloyd-Jones assessed Whitfield as, beyond any question, the greatest English preacher who has ever lived. Now, Lloyd-Jones, who at times expressed a forceful Welsh nationalism, added a characteristic qualification. His evaluation applied to England only. One of Whitfield's Welsh contemporaries, he added, Daniel Rowland, was his equal. But then Lloyd-Jones was prepared to claim that these two together were probably the greatest preachers since the days of the apostles. No mean claim. Other opinions have been rather less sweeping. The preeminent American church historian of the second quarter of the 20th century, William Warren Sweet, held that Whitfield was simply the greatest preacher of the century. Sidney Ahlstrom, an American church historian of the next generation, was prepared to go a bit further. He was one of the greatest preachers ever born. Few have doubted Whitfield's commanding powers as a deliverer of sermons. Some later commentators tried to dissect Whitfield's style to discover the secret of his power. One of the most thorough analyses appeared in an anonymous article in the Evangelical magazine in London for 1853. The characteristics singled out may say as much about mid-19th century priorities as the marks of Whitfield's presentations, but they do reveal what was most valued about the evangelist's legacy. First came the prominence given to the leading truths of salvation and the constant exaltation of Christ in them. Here was comment on the content. Whitfield concentrated on the basics of the gospel, pointing out the way to the new birth through dwelling on the work of the Saviour. Secondly, according to the Evangelical Magazine article, was the glow of feeling, a melting compassion which revealed his own soul. Whitfield, the writer was observing, showed a passionate empathy with his hearers. He not only proclaimed truths, but feeling them powerfully himself, he was eager to impress them on the hearts of his audiences. Next came the direct address of his ministry. As other commentators noted, Whitfield frequently used the word you. He spoke directly to each individual listening to his words. And last was his habitual dependence on the Spirit of God and his earnest aspiration for the manifestation of his power. Whitfield, that is to say, did not rely merely on techniques of his own invention, but sought the help and the blessing of the Holy Spirit in his ministry. The author was clearly hoping to rouse imitation of Whitfield by preachers in his own day, and there can be no doubt that he was successful. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the greatest preacher of the 19th century, was learning his art at exactly the time this piece appeared, and may well have read it. In any case, Spurgeon, sometimes called the modern Whitfield, certainly modelled his own pulpit ministry on Whitfield's career. Whitfield exercised a powerful influence over subsequent generations of evangelical preachers. More specifically, certain qualities of Whitfield's preaching style were commonly isolated. James Hamilton, a leading mid-19th century Presbyterian minister in London, remarked that his greatness lay not in his preparation, but in his delivery. Many declared Hamilton have surpassed him as a sermon maker, but none has approached him as a pulpit orator. Accordingly, it was the voice that was frequently emphasized. William Jay, long a congregational minister at Bath, recounted in the mid-19th century that he'd been told by Cornelius Winter, latterly Whitfield's lieutenant, that the evangelist's voice was incomparable because it was distinct, loud, and abounding in inflection. The Swedish historian of preaching, Archbishop Brilioth, writing in the mid-20th century, concluded that a melodic tone of voice and an expressive shading of address were Whitfield's greatest assets. To the voice, it was typically remembered that Whitfield added a full heart. He would pour emotion into his addresses, as commentators including William McLaughlin, a 20th century American historian of revivalism, has pointed out. The bare text of the sermons, according to McLaughlin, might seem banal, but the emotional content transfigured them. And Whitfield was a master of storytelling. He possessed, according to Joseph Belcher, a peculiar talent for making a narration of facts in the pulpit. The tales Whitfield told riveted his audience. So particular features of his manner were remembered as specially telling. Consequently, it has often been considered that Whitfield was a great loss to the stage. That is the prevailing line of interpretation in Harry Stout's biography of 1991, The Divine Dramatist, which set the tone for recent assessments of the preacher. But that had frequently been pointed out before. Belcher's popular account of 1857 recalled that the eminent actor David Garrick, a contemporary of Whitfield's, was reduced to weeping by the evangelist's bursts of passion. So Whitfield could make a powerful impression on the professionals of the stage. John Stoughton remarked in 1878 that since Whitfield was endowed with wonderful histrionic powers, he had qualities which would have made him a great actor. And Horton Davis, in a cooler assessment of 1961, pointed out not only that Whitfield possessed the actor's adaptability, but also that the London stage laughed at Whitfield because he denounced the stage, a rival attraction. This preacher threw the whole of his body into his delivery of a sermon, actor-like. In 1972, Sidney Ahlstrom reported that on one occasion, a German woman, knowing no English, heard Whitfield preach. She declared that she'd never heard a better sermon. The inference is clear. For the woman, the action of the preacher was decisive, not the content of his words. Whitfield has been remembered as a preacher who might have graced the stage as much as the pulpit. Thirdly, the evangelist. The message that Whitfield brought was consistently the opportunity of new birth. John Angel James, congregational minister in Birmingham, when speaking at a Whitfield commemoration in 1853, took as his text Philippians 3, verse 13, "This one thing I do." He meant to convey that Whitfield was single-minded. The evangelist, according to James, preached a gospel message of redemption and regeneration. Whitfield was remembered for carrying the message around Great Britain and her colonies as an energetic itinerant. Edwin Gaustat, a recent Baptist historian, spoke of the bustling, driving Whitfield as a one-man earthquake. His ministry in the open air was normally celebrated whenever he was discussed. After all, as Lloyd-Jones insisted, Whitfield was a pioneer of field preaching. The outcome was reported dramatically. Thus, the visit of Whitfield to Scotland to preach at Cambus Lang, according to W.G. Blakey, professor of the Free Church of Scotland in 1888, assembled multitudes. The results, Blakey declared, were like those of the day of Pentecost at Jerusalem. Whitfield, with his powerful voice, could address thousands at a time. Consequently, he's often been assessed as an inaugurator of the tradition of organized revivalism. That is how the sober historian of revivals, W.G. McLaughlin, regarded him. And that is how a more popular chronicler of revivalism, Bernard A. Weisberger, located him in the book of 1957. Whitfield, according to Weisberger, was mass evangelism's true father. There was a golden thread running from Whitfield to Billy Graham. That image led on to another that has exerted a potent influence over present-day assessments of Whitfield. In 1994, Frank Lambert depicted Whitfield as a man who employed all the marketing skills of a rising commercial society. Whitfield was a master of the media, in his case, the press and book publishing. Like Billy Graham, Whitfield took pains to gain good advance publicity. Other historians, however, have wanted to diminish his stature. Apart from those like Sidney Mead, who wanted to dismiss his large-scale events as mere emotional upheavals, there have been others like Sidney Armstrong who have wished to place Whitfield's contribution to the Great Awakening in a broader perspective. Although many were inspired to imitate Whitfield, Armstrong suggested, the chief work of reviving New England was carried forward by regular ministers rather than by itinerants. Those who made this point could draw on a well-established estimate of Whitfield. He was perceived, often by contrast with Wesley, as no organization man. Whitfield, unlike his contemporaries, left no denomination behind him in England or the colonies. His Calvinistic Methodist network dissolved through his neglect. Belcher put the point epigrammatically in 1857. Whitfield was soul, Wesley was system. The same case was presented with some rhetorical exaggeration by Stuart Henry, a Methodist writer a century later. It was the characteristic of the free soul Whitfield that he had no commerce with organized religion and religious organizations as such. As a traveling evangelist, Whitfield was not to be tied down to mere bureaucracy. In the eyes of many, that was a defect rather than as a strength. Yet Whitfield, it was widely acknowledged, had made huge and enduring impacts by his evangelism. In Wales, the Calvinistic Methodist network did survive, though far more through the efforts of Whitfield's Welsh colleagues, led by Howell Harris, than through his own. Lloyd-Jones claimed Whitfield as the first moderator of the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church, though with some anachronism, since that body did not organise separately from the Church of England until 1811. But in the 19th century, that body rose to become the largest nonconformist denomination in Wales. In England, Congregationalism benefited greatly from Whitfield's gospel preaching. In Gloucestershire, Whitfield's native county in particular, a series of congregations owing their origins to the evangelist, with Rodborough Tabernacle as their fulcrum, was served by dedicated lay preachers long into the 19th century. Elsewhere, strong individual congregations, often called tabernacles, gradually turned into congregational churches. Thus, at Plymouth, Andrew Kinsman, who had been converted through reading at Whitfield's sermon in 1740, became a regular preacher at Whitfield's tabernacle at Plymouth in 1750. After Kinsman's death, it became an ordinary but vigorous congregational church. The Baptists of England benefited from individuals rather than whole congregations. Between 1760 and 1820, the particular Baptist churches of London drew a majority of their ministers from outside the Baptist ranks, and a high proportion of them were Whitfieldites. The highly influential Baptist minister at Cambridge, Robert Robinson, for example, had been converted under Whitfield. the evangelical movement of the Church of England, owed Whitfield a great debt. Whitfield, himself an Anglican clergyman, was a model for many later men, even if they normally preferred to serve in a particular parish rather than itinerating. And Rowland Hill, Whitfield's chief nominally Anglican disciple in the next generation, maintained his travelling methods down to his death in 1833. And the American colonies perhaps benefited most from Whitfield's ministry. Many converted under his preaching stayed in their home congregations, whether Congregational, Presbyterian, or Anglican. But others, seeking committed gospel ministers and converted church members, left New England Congregationalism to form separate congregational churches, and many of them evolved into Baptist churches. Two particularly significant figures who'd been awakened under Whitfield followed that path, Shubal Stearns and Daniel Marshall. They moved from New England to Sandy Creek, North Carolina in 1755, forming a Baptist church and soon an association. From its vigorous growth, a Whitfieldite development led on to the creation of the whole Baptist movement in the South. The roots of Southern Baptists in revivalism, Whitfieldite revivalism, are evidenced by the altar calls which still mark their services at all types of Southern Baptist churches to this day. Ultimately, that practice is testimony to the legacy of George Whitfield. Fourthly, the Calvinist. It was hard to remember Whitfield without encountering his Calvinism. The teaching of the Genevan Reformer not only coloured Whitfield's preaching, but also led him to a fierce exchange with the Arminian John Wesley. Denominations with a Reformed inheritance long approved this aspect of the evangelist. In the mid-19th century, the Baptist Joseph Belcher still asserted in America that the secret of Whitfield's power lay in his theology, though he stressed not its Calvinistic nature, but its perfect simplicity and universal application. Alexander Thompson, in paying tribute to John Calvin on behalf of the Congregational Union of England and Wales on the tercentenary of the Reformer's death in 1864, listed Whitfield as one of those influenced for good by Calvin. And Charles Hodge of Princeton Seminary, a keen exponent of Reformed teaching, claimed that the success of the Great Awakening that Whitfield led was the result of its Calvinistic doctrine. But Calvinism started to fall into decay from the mid-19th century onwards. The evangelist Dwight L. Moody was typical of the late 19th century in trying to preach in a way which was acceptable to Calvinists and Methodists alike. His successor, Billy Sunday, still favoured Whitfield, but not because he was a Calvinist. Sunday once urged going back to old-time truths, the truths preached by Finney, Wesley, Whitfield, the Puritans, and Martin Luther, a mixture of Calvinists and anti-Calvinists. If Whitfield was valued in the later 19th and early 20th centuries, it was usually not because he was a Calvinist. The resulting ambiguities in attitudes towards Whitfield are evident in the biography of the evangelist published by J.P. Gledstone, superintendent of Whitfield's Tottenham Court Road Chapel in London in 1871. Admiration for the man who, with his brethren, reanimated the dying religion of the whole British people breathes through Gledstone's pages. But the author is embarrassed by Whitfield's Calvinism. Gledstone puts in a good word for the evangelist's theological convictions. His Calvinism was not, as it never is in the purest hearts, a cold system of divinity. Instead, according to Gledstone, it embodied the truth that man must in no sense be a saviour of himself. Yet Gledstone regrets that Whitfield ever launched into any system. In particular, he laments that the evangelist held the dark and terrible doctrine of reprobation, but counters by claiming that Whitfield lacked all bigotry and believed in the infinite love of God more firmly than in anything else. Something of why Gledstone took this line is apparent from various other remarks he makes. He believed in the motif of spontaneous growth in the spiritual life, if not inhibited by stunted forms. And he eagerly insisted that Whitfield had a love for scenery, so that he was not a dull soul without delight in nature. Here was an interpretation of Whitfield that drew on the romantic cultural categories of growth and nature. Whitfield was fitted into a preconceived notion of what any sensitive soul must feel. Hence, the firmer doctrinal affirmations of the Reformed faith were treated as unwelcome incidentals in Whitfield's story. The tendency was taken further in the 20th century. Distaste for Calvinism actually marginalised Whitfield altogether. In the long popular History of the Christian Church, published in 1918 by Williston Walker, Congregationalist who taught at Yale from 1901 onwards, Whitfield is treated as an outlier in an account of the Wesleys and Methodism. Only five sentences are recorded in a very long book to Whitfield's career in America. In the biographies of Whitfield of this period, Calvinism is deprecated. Thus, in Belden's English biography of 1930, Whitfield is described as caught in Calvin's obsession with the element of necessity in life. And in the American biography by the Methodist Stuart Henry in 1957, there's an elaborate attempt to exculpate Whitfield from the crime of Calvinism. Whitfield, it is conceded, upheld the Calvinistic creed, but his vigorous faith could not be confined by it, and so he preached that man could not man could help to save himself. He professed Calvinism, went on Stuart Henry, lived by an Arminian faith, and preached them both. Thus Whitfield was remoulded to fit the presuppositions of the age. Yet, Whitfield was to contribute to the Reformed resurgence that marked the later years of the 20th century. An early expression was in the circle of Genevan theologians who tried to arouse English Congregationalism to a sense of its Reformed inheritance from the 1930s onwards. B.L. Manning, one of their number, who was a fellow in medieval history at Jesus College, Cambridge, wrote in 1939 that behind all living Calvinism is the evangelical experience of the saved soul. And instanced intriguingly, Augustine, medieval theologian Bradwardine, Calvin, and Whitfield. More influential in reviving Calvinism was the movement associated with the Banner of Truth magazine, launched in England in 1955. The logo chosen for the magazine and the large number of Puritan reprints that soon started to appear was a statue of George Whitfield, the one on your logo for this conference. The evangelist loomed large in the propaganda of the movement. It was commonly held that Calvinism, by leaving the choice of the elect to the Almighty, inhibited active efforts to spread the gospel. That was a common view at the time. But one of the great lessons of Whitfield, according to Martin Lloyd-Jones, was to nail the lie which says that Calvinism and an interest in evangelism are not compatible. Thus, Whitfield played a significant part in one of the major theological developments of the later 20th century. His Calvinism was an active agent in subsequent history. Fifthly, the cooperator. Whitfield believed in cooperation between Christians who'd experienced the new birth. He was willing to preach for all groups who shared that faith, whatever their denominational affiliation. Thus, when invited to Scotland by the seceding Presbyterians who believed that the Church of Scotland abandoned scripture standards of belief and practice, Whitfield travelled north but refused to be bound to preach for these seceders alone, and so received their bountiful anathemas. The preacher's interdenominational temper was often praised in later years. Gladstone, writing in 1871, dedicated his biography to the memory of an evangelist who was not only self-sacrificing, but also Catholic, because he believed in Christian cooperation. Whitfield was, according to Gladstone, a brother of all who in every place and under any denomination call upon the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. By the second edition of his biography, 30 years later in 1901, Gladstone went further. It was a period when the free churches of England and Wales were coming together in joint councils to pursue common work. noting that Whitfield was ahead of his times in declaring that no form of church government excludes all other forms, Gladstone exclaimed, "Is that not the ideal of Christian fellowship toward which all churches are moving?" Likewise, in America, Williston Walker commented in 1918 that Whitfield held views more typical of the early 20th century than of the 18th century. Whitfield was a man absolutely without denominational feeling, in an age when such feelings were intense. Whitfield was presented as a pioneer ecumenist. Others interpreted Whitfield's spirit of cooperation rather differently. Whitfield, they recognized, was unwilling to hold out the hand of fellowship to all. On the contrary, he denounced, especially in his early years, the clergy who did not preach a soul-saving gospel. His condemnations were severe and sometimes, as he later admitted, unfounded. This censorious disposition was often made a leading ground of criticism by those unsympathetic to Whitfield in later years. But the insistence on placing boundaries around the groups with whom cooperation was possible found favour elsewhere. In the 1960s, Martin Lloyd-Jones, the architect of the Calvinistic resurgence in Britain, was prepared to end relations with others if they would not join him in an exclusively evangelical fellowship. He disliked the ecumenical trends of his day because of the associated doctrinal laxity. He urged all his fellow believers to leave their existing denominations in order to form a purely evangelical body. Accordingly, his interpretation of Whitfield's cooperative spirit differed from that of those who discerned a proto-ecumenist. One of the lessons of Whitfield, according to Lloyd-Jones, was the need for orthodox faith. Accordingly, the evangelist was admirable because, like Calvin, he urged unity among evangelicals alone. Whitfield, paradoxically, was presented by Lloyd-Jones as an anti-ecumenical figure because of the limits on cooperation. Yet the cooperative dimension of Whitfield's ministry was so striking that even Methodists were persuaded of its importance. As Arminians, they might have been expected to find grounds for condemning Whitfield, but in general, they approved him. It is true that Henry C. Sheldon, a Methodist professor at Boston University, writing in 1894, when recounting the estrangement between Whitfield and Wesley over Calvinism, took the side of Wesley, insisting that he could not have done otherwise in the dispute. But the normal Methodist approach was to minimize criticism of Whitfield. Whitfield practically belonged to no denomination, according to his Methodist biographer Luke Tyman in 1876, but was a friend to all. Whitfield brought more benefits to Methodism, Tyman argued, than was usually imagined. In the American colonies, for example, he prepared the way for Wesley's itinerants, who first arrived in the New World in the year before Whitfield's death. Similarly, Stuart Henry, a Methodist writer in 1957, recorded that Whitfield was willing to work with any who agreed with him on essentials. That his conception of essentials, Henry went on, was less flexible than our own is a characteristic of his century, not of his creed. Consequently, Methodists were prepared to see Whitfield as almost one of their own. In the Revivalist magazine, issued from Louth in Lincolnshire in England in the 1850s, Whitfield's ministry was several times held up for total admiration. And the New England Methodist Conference chose to hold its 1851 session in the building over the very crypt which held Whitfield's bones, symbolizing its appropriation of the spirit of the evangelist by venerating his body. Doctrinal disagreement did not prevent Methodists from recognizing Whitfield's eminence as a preacher of the gospel. His cooperative spirit won over potential critics over the centuries. Sixthly, the American. America figures large in Whitfield's posthumous reputation. His seven tours through the colonies meant that he was closely identified with the New World. David Kerry Jones has emphasized Whitfield's international role through his correspondence as well. Historians have highlighted aspects of his American ministry. Thus, William Warren Sweet, in A General History of Religion in America, allocated as many as 4 pages to Whitfield's scheme for an orphanage in Georgia alone. Whitfield became entangled in slavery, as is well known, defending the institution and becoming a slaveholder himself. And here was a facet of Whitfield's role in America that has attracted censure, especially from more recent historians such as Gordon Rupp and Stephen J. Stein. But both orphanage and slavery rooted Whitfield in American soil. The evangelist's Americanness could sometimes be turned to surprising ends. In 1930, for example, the British Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, actually celebrated Whitfield in a book foreword as a transatlantic cultural bond. "It is particularly happy," MacDonald wrote, "that this story of the greatest evangelist of the English-speaking race should be a heritage held in common by our American cousins and ourselves." Whitfield, MacDonald asserted, was therefore a harbinger of world peace. He might bring the nations together. Earlier, however, Whitfield had been a cause of transatlantic rivalry. Some biographers dwelt on his Englishness. For Gladstone in 1871, for example, he was an Englishman with a rough, unsparing hand and an honest heart. Assertions of England's claims on Whitfield led to contention over his bones. There was dissatisfaction that his mortal remains lay in the crypt of a Presbyterian church in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Surely they should be buried in his native land. In particular, the congregations of Whitfield's former churches in London wanted his remains returned to England. And that was true in the 19th century, but Albert Belden, superintendent of one of them, still hoped to achieve that goal as late as 1931. "I confess," declared the evangelist Henry Vincent on visiting Whitfield's mausoleum in 1867, "that as an Englishman, I envy America the possession of the earthly remains of dear George Whitfield." Because Whitfield's skeleton was on open display at Newburyport, there was actually opportunity for international theft. In the 1820s, Robert Bolton, Congregational minister at Henley-on-Thames in England, asked a friend travelling to America to obtain a Whitfield autograph for him. Instead, the friend actually stole the main bone of Whitfield's right arm from the Newburyport crypt and sent it in a parcel to Henley-on-Thames. Bolton was aghast, but he did not return the bone until 1849, when it was restored to its place in a solemn ceremony. It is extraordinary that international rivalry went so far. The question of the extent of Whitfield's identification with colonial discontents arises at this point. How far was he involved in the currents of feeling that led to the American Revolution? Church historians touched on the issue in the later 20th century. Winthrop S. Hudson, writing in 1965, described the Great Awakening as doing more to create a national consciousness amongst the various colonies than either colonial wars or what he calls political squabbles with the mother country, pointing to Whitfield as one of the rallying names. There was stress on Whitfield's role in binding together the colonies in a common cause. George Whitfield, according to Ahlstrom, was perhaps the first American public figure to be known from New Hampshire to Georgia. In 1966, general historian Alan Heimart entered the fray, arguing that evangelical Calvinism forged the radical ideology that lay behind the revolution. Lambert's biography, published in 1994, took up that theme in relation to Whitfield, contending that the evangelist was Americanized, for example, in resisting the wish of the Archbishop of Canterbury to make his Bethesda orphanage an exclusively Anglican institution on the grounds of the unconquerable attachment of Americans to toleration principles. This line was taken to an extreme in a popular biography of 2001 by Stephen Mansfield, who was subsequently to write of the faith of Presidents Bush and Obama, and also a remarkable book published only last year called Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. Mansfield's title labeled Whitfield America's forgotten founding father, actively teaching revolutionary ideals. But such an estimate of Whitfield cannot be sustained. He died in 1770, long before the revolution, and was himself no politician. A more judicial verdict has been offered by Tommy Kidd. Great Awakening had at most an indirect effect on the revolution by providing a form of moralistic popular address that mobilised the population. In this field, Whitfield was a master, and to that extent, he contributed to the processes leading to American independence. Whitfield, then, may have swayed America, but he was no simple politician. Seventhly, the icon. Whitfield became a figure venerated in popular memory. He aroused extraordinary flights of language. Robert Baird, though a sober Presbyterian commentator on American religious affairs, wrote in 1840 that Whitfield was like an angel symbolized in the apocalypse as flying through the heavens, having the everlasting gospel to preach to the nations. Places were long associated with his memory. The villages of Ipswich, Massachusetts, were still calling a large stone Whitfield's pulpit in the 1840s. As late as 1913, Brookfield, Massachusetts, had Whitfield's Rock. The crypt at Newburyport Presbyterian Church, where Whitfield's bones lay, was turned into a shrine. In 1775, American soldiers on their way to rouse Canada, as they expected, for the Patriot cause, stopped in Newburyport to hear a sermon in the church. Afterwards, their officers dutifully filed down into the crypt, the coffin of Whitfield was opened, and they snipped off parts of his collar and wristbands to take as sacred tokens into battle. Once the body had decomposed into a skeleton, it remained on public display. In the late 19th century, a glass lid was added to the coffin, and a cast of Whitfield's skull was provided so that visitors could hold the reproduction rather than, as in the past, the original. Meanwhile, in Gloucestershire, England, Rodborough Tabernacle preserved Whitfield's chair, his bureau, and even his tea caddy. When, in 1839, the Congregational ministers of the county organised a public meeting in the open air to commemorate the preacher, some 20,000 people thronged together. A few fastidious persons, it was recorded, thought the preachers dwelt more on Whitfield than was seemly. Whitfield, in fact, was elevated to something like the status of a Roman Catholic saint. He became a popular icon. Much of this commemoration was not merely antiquarian. It was keenly hoped that his achievements could be reproduced in a later age. At the 1839 event, the crowd sang a hymn written for the occasion by Josiah Conder, the leading congregational litterateur of the day. Where is the voice of Whitfield now? Where does his mantle rest? Oh, for Elisha's from the plough, with kindred zeal possessed. Similar sentiments resounded down the years. What Alexander and Caesar are to those who have not yet ceased to learn war, wrote Belcher in America in 1857, that Whitfield and Wesley are to those who aspire to eminent usefulness as ministers and messengers of the cross. The Christian, the English periodical most committed to revivalism, urged its readers to circulate Gladstone's biography of Whitfield in 1871. Every page has something that may be turned to account in service for Christ. Even among early 20th century ministers swayed by liberal theological currents, Whitfield remained for some an exemplar. Albert Belden, though acclaiming modern theological findings, hoped that through his new biography of Whitfield in 1930, fire should fall from heaven again upon the churches. Whitfield was to be admired rather than evaluated. That feeling led to a sharp controversy amongst Calvinists on the publication of Harry Stout's study of Whitfield in 1991. Stout, himself an upholder of Reformed theology, but professor of American Christianity at Yale Divinity School, was assailed by the editor of the Banner of Truth, Ian Murray, for daring to criticize Whitfield. Stout defended himself robustly. Critical evaluation, he claimed, was legitimate. But that episode illustrates that to many, Whitfield was above criticism. He remained, in some eyes, an icon. Overall, Whitfield then left a multiform legacy. His reputation as a man varied, with detractors as well as eulogists. As a preacher, however, he was remembered as a superb exponent of pulpit style. He was an evangelist whose impact remoulded many Christian traditions. Whitfield's Calvinism was sometimes an embarrassment to subsequent writers, but he helped inspire the Reformed resurgence of the later 20th century. His cooperative spirit was favorably received by posterity, but it interpreted in contrasting ways according to the different opinions of his assessors. Whitfield's American credentials have been contested, and his influence over the Revolution exaggerated. But he became a popular icon, venerated in many circles. Here was a diverse character whose various aspects could be emphasized from time to time according to the preferences of commentators. One thing was certain. As Elizabeth Charles' character says in her novel, The Diary of Mrs. Kitty Trevelyan, Whitfield was no commonplace fanatic. Thank you very much.
Time for some questions.
One down here.
Steve?
I've missed a lot of sessions, and this may be common knowledge, I'm not sure. I wanted to know, when he prepared, though you mentioned that he didn't do as much, he wasn't known as much for his preparation as it was his oration. Did he cite different pastors or did he often cite different pastors and theologians of his time, and who would he reference or who would he mention, and who would he attribute his understanding of theology in the Bible to? Just Calvin, or are there other people that he would, get his source from?
In polemical contributions to debate, he would readily acknowledge his legacy to the whole Calvinist tradition. But in preaching, which you rightly focus on as being his central achievement and the thing for which he was celebrated, he didn't quote theologians. He quoted a higher authority than that. He quoted the Bible and often appealed to the Holy Spirit himself as the author of Scripture. And I think he did that quite deliberately, because he wanted to show that his message was the very message from God, challenging people to the new birth. And that was remembered. That was remembered down the centuries.
Quick answer, the fivefold ministry. Do you think that is the work of an evangelist, mainly, with the concerning, like you mentioned, D.L. Moody, along with Billy Graham? Billy Graham refused to even come to Paducah, Kentucky, where I was at, because the Church of Christ would not send a member to meet him at the airport. And so do you think that is the work of an evangelist to bring everybody on board? D.L. Moody brought some Catholics on there who confessed Jesus Christ, and he brought them all to the same table. Do you think that is the work of that particular office of evangelist to bring everybody on board, lay your doctrine at the door, leave your ego at the door, and come and do one purpose, that is to witness and save souls? Do you think that is the main job of an evangelist, to do what he did, to bring everybody, Wesley, Edwards, hey, come, we got to do the job to do together. Let's not break our friendship whatsoever. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's very difficult to leave ego at the door entirely. I don't think Whitfield entirely succeeded. I think it's impossible to leave doctrine at the door entirely. I don't think any evangelist has succeeded in that, even if they've tried. However, I do think that the purpose of an evangelist, specifically, that calling that you pin on, is to preach the gospel and to do nothing else, unless they have a parallel calling, of course. But as evangelists, their job is to preach the gospel, and it is their obligation, yes, to maximize it. I must say, I really rather admire Billy Graham, because he used the modern technical research methods of social science in the 1950s in order to investigate what the nature of the places was that he was going to visit. He may not have been very good about travel from the airport at Paducah, I'm sorry about that. But in general, he did manage to find out the social characteristics of the area that he was going to visit. I've looked at the archives of the Billy Graham Organization at Wheaton College, and he did superb His agents did superb reporting on Britain before he did his British missions in the mid-1950s. Some very interesting comments on what was going on in Britain from a critical outside observer, which I rather cherish. But he found out, he knew, he sent spies to spy out the land. And for that, there is excellent biblical precedent. Yes, the front row usually contributes. Thank you.
Most people in Britain have never heard of George Whitefield today, so it seems that his memory has died.
It is interesting that the Tottenham Court Road Chapel, which did commemorate his memory in the very centre of London as Whitefield's Tabernacle, is now the American International Church. When it was in its former guise, my father-in-law attended it as a young lad in London, and he was very aware of Whitefield in the 1930s. Now one of my former research students is minister of the American church there, and I don't think he preaches about Whitefield. I'm not sure Whitefield is very prominent in his memory. I perhaps need to have a word with him about that. You're right about the bulk of the United Kingdom. I don't, however, think that that's entirely true of Gloucestershire. I think Gloucestershire is odd. Gloucestershire is a place where distinct memories linger, and especially in that Rodborough Tabernacle area, I think there are memories of the man, and some linger in Bristol too. I think he's regarded as a Gloucestershire worthy, and Gloucestershire worthies are to be commemorated. They're also good for the tourist trade. There's one over there.
I was just going to ask more about the, if you had any observations more narrowly on the iconography in terms of the pictures and statues and so on of Whitefield. I know Wesley's busts over the course of the 19th century, as Methodism grew in confidence, Wesley's chin got higher and higher in the busts. But any thoughts on the, more narrowly, the iconography?
Well, I learned a bit about the iconography today in that I learned that that statue was erected in 1865. I learned that, I believe, from your own presentation earlier, Bruce, if that's not right. Which is very interestingly exactly the juncture when this novel was produced. I do wonder whether the two are connected. Whitefield was the object of much less iconography than Wesley because he left no denomination. Wesleyan Methodists went in for the production of busts of Wesley. It kept certain pottery works in Stoke-on-Trent very busy throughout the first two-thirds of the 19th century, and actually contributed to the decoration of my front room at home in Stirling. There was no equivalent for Whitefield in terms of a denomination providing a basis. Yes, in Wales there was an enduring Calvinistic Methodist denomination, but they produced the occasional bust of Howell Harris and the native Welsh heroes. So in terms of statuettes, I think it's much less significant. In terms of portraiture, I do not know the answer. I do not know of anybody who's actually done work on the portraiture that represents Whitefield. Somebody somewhere will know about that, possibly somebody in this room. But again, because there is no institutional base, there hasn't been the foundation for such work. There is a centre at Oxford Brookes University for Methodist and church history studies. And at that centre, there's a specialist who's looked at the iconography of Wesley and collected objects and does presentations. But there is no equivalent institutional base for Whitefield. I think that's something he's lacked. Possibly the 300th anniversary of his birth may lead to future developments in that area.
Just to add a piece of information about the theft of the forearm, there is also a thumb missing, which is in the archives of Drew University. And if Rob John is still here, he will show you the photograph that he took at Harvard a month ago of one of Whitefield's ribs.
Right.
I have suggested to him that he talk to the History Channel and they get the body of Whitefield CT scanned or MRI scanned to see if there's anything else missing.
If you keep bits of people in your basement and allow free access, this is going to happen. But clearly, this is significant because it means that people wanted to have them and thought it sufficiently valuable for them to possess these objects rather than this place where Whitfield had been laid at his death. And I must say, this gives me very strong recollections of what went on in some monasteries of the High Middle Ages. On one occasion, a team was sent out from the monastery at Ely into the further depths of East Anglia to do a raid on another monastery where they had a particular relic that they were very keen to possess. The raid was successful. They surprised the monks at the other monastery, made off with the sacred relic, brought it back in triumph to Ely, and the chronicler of the monastery at Ely says, "How marvelous that God blessed this sacred theft." And he goes on at great length about this marvelous paradox of how wonderful it is to have stolen this really good thing so cleverly. Now, I think when you get into relics, something becomes very odd about human beings. That is true of the monks of Ely. That is also true of the bones of Whitfield.
Question for today's biographer or PhD student looking for a dissertation. Any area of Whitfield that is yet to be explored for today's research?
An enormous lot. I would refer you chiefly to my colleague at Baylor, Tommy Kidd, who spoke yesterday and was here till lunchtime, who knows about it. I do not. I do not inhabit the 18th century. I inhabit the 19th and 20th centuries chiefly, occasionally visiting the 21st. Therefore, I'm not really familiar, I'm afraid, with the most obvious openings. Tommy Kidd at Baylor University will be able to give you precise guidance on that. However, what I can say, and this follows on from what I've been trying to do today, is that an enormous lot of research in the 21st century has been done on other figures in relating to their representation. There's a whole course at my university in Scotland about the representation of major figures from the past in art, but also on paper, and also in many other ways, in popular memory, in folklore. And I do think that a lot could be done on that, on Whitfield in America, in Britain, and I think that would be a very productive study that would actually be au courant with contemporary historiographical trends. If you want a job out of a PhD, it's always a very good idea to be au fait with current historiographical patterns. To do this, therefore, to look at the representations of Whitfield subsequently would be a very good way of getting a job with remuneration at the end of it. And if that's your aim, study the 19th and 20th centuries, not the 18th.
One last question.
Oh.
You know, it's clear that Whitfield, you know, even amongst the giants of preaching and evangelicalism, he stands like a titan, you know, among them. And my question then is, you know, knowing that he has such an impact on Christianity during his time and era, what do you think is his greatest impact or lesson for us in contemporary evangelicalism?
Okay. The greatest greatness of Whitfield is as a preacher, not as a preparer, but as a deliverer of sermons. And you need to focus with any individual on what makes them, what made them greatest. So let's focus on him as a deliverer of sermons. He used all the skills available to an actor. I don't think that made him an actor. I don't think he was an actor, but he used all the skills available to them because he was doing a public performance. He was standing in public, used the inflection of his voice, used gestures, seized his gown from time to time and shook it. He used all the skills that were possible to communicate his message in terms of the backing for that message. Therefore, he maximized the impact accompanied with prayer and invocation for the help of the Spirit, which he so amply received, of course. The lesson that I think that gives us is that whatever your hand turns to, do it to the utmost of your power. If you have histrionic skills, develop them. If you're really good, not at histrionic skills, but being a Christian sportsman on the baseball or football ground, then be a Christian sportsman to the utmost of your skills. If you're a preacher, do what Whitfield did, develop your particular skills to the utmost of your power. That's what Whitfield is. That, I think, is his chief lesson.